Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Small Council Radio. So, tonight we are going to be talking about kind of a last-minute subject that was requested by a handful of people on Facebook. So, with AdeptCon being canceled and all the craziness happening, we had, like, the next 6 weeks scheduled out, but it's kind of all, you know, probably not going to happen, unfortunately, but... you know, once DevCon, you know, picks back up, or maybe GenCon or something, you know, we'll have a lot more to talk about in the way of competitive gaming. Hopefully you guys were able to listen to some of the other, videos or any of the other content out there talking about the big tournament in, where was it, France, Brett, for the 100-man tournament?
Yeah, it was in Paris. It was scheduled for 100 people. They ended up having 96, which is still incredibly impressive. 96 people playing
yeah.
A Song of Ice and Fire. I really hope we get to that level in the United States, and I think we can do it here in the next year or two. I'm imagining whenever some events start happening, I think people are going to be busting through the doors just to get themselves, you know, back in physical contact with gamers and coughing on each other's dice and stuff. I'm just kidding about that, but no, seriously, I think when the places open back up, everybody's going to be so ready to get back in and start rolling some dice in real life with their friends. So I think the first couple of events are going to be huge and have some serious turnout. So,
well, to be totally honest, I think we could easily get close, if not more than that, at AdeptCon. It's just space. Like the 60 or 64 spots we had already was already like pushing it. Like AdeptCon is already so packed every year that getting seating is not an easy task. It's only because, you know, Martin's awesome and he, you know, he's such an awesome guy and he has some connections that he was able to kind of get the community some more spots. I truly believe that we could get close, if not more than what they had over in Paris. But yeah. So tonight we are going to be talking about the five competitive missions that you'll see pretty much at every tournament, and how to kind of list build, for them, what each mission, you know, kind of needs in order to get a leg up against your opponent. Definitely building to not only what your opponent, like what factions you might see, but missions is a big one. Missions is a lot, in my opinion, a lot more reliable to build your list against rather than what you might face, because there's only five mission options and you're going to usually see at least three of them. Whereas if you're playing, you know, in a, let's say even like a 20 to 30 person tournament, you know, there's what, seven factions now if you count neutrals, and then so many different variations of those factions, it's a lot less reliable to build your list to a faction, though it still has its merit. Building your list to missions is a lot more reliable. So that's what we're going to kind of be discussing tonight. For those that don't, that are kind of the first time listening, for this show, we do it weekly, every 8 p.m. For Central Standard Time. We do this show live so that you guys can kind of call in. So if you're listening to this either right now or after the fact, just know that while we're live, there should be a phone number that you guys can dial in. And we're going to start changing up to where instead of like the end of the show, unless maybe we have some guests or something on, we're going to start letting you guys come on as soon as I see you pop on, because I've noticed that a lot of you will call in and listen in that way for like 5-10 minutes and then drop off before I ever get to that chance to let you on. So yeah, just call in if you are wanting to kind of give your you know, 2 cents on the subject, and I will definitely do that. We don't have time to let a ton of people on, but if I see you on and we have time, I'll definitely let you get on and, you know, either ask any of us a question or just, you know, give your 2 cents. So first up, thank you guys, my co-hosts, for coming on. Tonight we have Brett and Jose, and I think later we might have Justin and Chris. We'll see, though. But, yeah, thank you guys for coming on. You know, you guys are on pretty much every single week.
Yeah,
no
sure.
Problem.
Yeah, no problem.
So First mission we're going to kind of talk about, for those that are able to follow, I don't know what you guys are doing, if you're painting or whatnot, we're going to be going through Game of Thrones, Clash of Kings, Feast for Crows, Dance with Dragons, and Fire and Blood. And we're going to go right in the order on the app. So if you're following through and you want to just kind of follow that way, you can. So first up will be Game of Thrones, and kind of, you know, way to build your list to, you know, help yourself out with this one. Brett, what do you think about this one?
Game of Thrones is actually, well, I mean, it's the perennial scenario, in my opinion. It's kind of one that, obviously it involves the objective tokens, which, guys that aren't used to playing a game that has the objective token, aspect, it's a really good scenario to start practicing to get familiar with the other side of the game. So I know that a lot of people, especially the Stark players, right, are incredibly bloodthirsty. And I think that, some people still kind of get this thing in your head where you have to kill everything or even outkill your opponent. But Game of Thrones is a mission that proves that you can maybe even lose more combat units or give up more combat unit points than your opponent does, and you can still win the scenario because it's very much about controlling those objectives and getting to 10 victory points, whether it's by victory through combat or the objectives. I really, really like the change that they made to Game of Thrones where the center is worth 2 victory points. I think when that was a random choice, that game could really be decided pretty quickly if the double victory point was closer to one opponent's table side and it gave too much control to the D6 to decide who picks table side. So I'm going to give the developers kudos for making that change there. And yeah, if you want the double victory points, you're going to be front and center right in the middle of the field where everybody's going to be able to get to you, presumably. And then you have to take that panic test at -2 when you score the points from it. So I think from where I'm standing, I'm going to use probably my more defensive list in this scenario, a list that's designed to take a punch and hold the point. And I think having multiple combat units is going to benefit you in this scenario as well, because you've got 5 objective tokens and even an insignificant unit like you Free Folk players, they can sit on an objective and score points. So, you're going to have Starks running their Dire Wolves, and you're going to have Raiders and those guys running around sitting on these objective tokens. You've got to kind of be able to hold a point on the field and be able to kind of countercharge when they dogpile on whatever unit you have. So this scenario is interesting. I've won this scenario more than a few times without ever actually killing a combat unit of my opponent's. So it's a scenario that I like. A little bit different. It's a little bit interesting, but yeah, there's several ways that you can approach it. But yeah, that's my take on that. Is it's my more defensive scenario. I'm wanting to get on objective tokens. I'll defend them with a hammer type unit if I have to, but preferably just going to, you know, score those passive points by controlling objectives.
Yeah, I would say exactly what you said, Brett. Usually in this situation, it's something, like you said, a more defensive sit on tokens. This is not something that, I mean, in general, I rarely use 3MTUs, but this is not something I bring 3MTUs to. Like you said, you want to have more units on the table. They give you the upper hand to fight and hold the objectives. so that's, yeah, I mean, basically, I agree with everything that you've said.
Yeah, so one thing to keep in mind with this mission, you have a potential of 6 points if you can somehow grab every objective and hold them to the end of round 2. This is the mission, in my opinion, that, you know, if you get an early lead, you know, like 4 or 5, 6 points in the very first turn, that it's usually, you know, I've never seen someone lose that was able to get 5 points in end of round 2, because at that point that means they're on 4 of the objectives, one of them being the 2-pointer, and unless you can get them off most of those objectives, they just have to sit there and wait and just, you know, get those 10 victory points and they're good. So it's definitely something you're, that gives a lot of merit to the free maneuver first turn, if, especially if you're a slow army. Starks, with all their speed, and even, like, I don't know if I would necessarily say Targaryens. They have a lot of speed, but with them really wanting that charge, it's hard to say that they're going to want to just run up, grab the objectives, being cav. But Starks, I think, have the biggest advantage, maybe Free Folk as well, because Starks have all the speed with still having a lot of hitting power while in combat for infantry units. Whereas, like I was saying, Targaryens, they're going to have the cav, and they can get on the objectives faster than most armies. But, you know, in this mission, it's based on ranks. So you might be keeping your opponent from getting it because you're on it as Targaryens. But if they're infantry, you have to get them down. If you're at full, you're going to have to at least take a rank off of them. But if you're getting on it first, they're more than likely charging you, meaning, you know, if they can take you down a rank, now you got to take them down two ranks. It's just, it's kind of a hard mission for Targaryens. Definitely winnable, but as Targaryens, I think this is a mission where you're going to want a mixture of cav and some sort of infantry, whether it be the Unsullied when they come out, or, you know, some neutrals spliced in a second list. Definitely keep in mind that, you know, most tournaments, at least major tournaments, you're going to be allowed two lists. And this is, you know, one of those things where if you're encountering, you know, either a mission or whatnot that's really bad for your army, you know, just kind of go into the realm of, you know, neutrals or just something that you normally wouldn't play that's going to help you with this, because something you might not normally play, like neutrals and Targaryens, whether it be like Blackguard or Cutthroats or whatnot, it's going to definitely take you a long way. Just keep that in mind. Also, this mission doesn't have a benefit for a field commander, so definitely some merit to an NCU commander in this mission. Give you more points on the field, because definitely more units will help you with a better chance of grabbing more objectives at once. You know, especially if, you know, your Starks, if you have five combat units, especially if you have some wolves, if you march past the objectives, if your opponent's being too reserved or they're just too slow on the field, and then you can cap the objectives with the wolves and, you know, use your combat units as screening units so that they can't attack your wolves. I've had it, fortunately only had it done once to me, but it's devastating when you see that. When you see these wolves that, yes, now they're worth a victory point, but they're sitting on an objective and they're racking up points against you, especially if you can get a wolf on that center one. I mean, a wolf, though you can still fail and be auto-killed from the -2 panic, I mean, it's still a 4-up morale. Though I guess if you're Lannister, Cersei is definitely a power play in that regard, that you could, you know, a wolf on a 6-up is pretty devastating. So keep that in mind, you know, one list with a field commander maybe, and one list with an NCU commander, and then, you know, maybe three NCUs, but, you know, saving those extra points for combat units, because I feel like elite lists in this mission are still good, but you definitely have to do some working around to make sure that you make things count, because if your opponent is outnumbering you and is able to get on those objectives and just weather your elite attacks, it might be game over right there. So just definitely be careful in that regard, especially if they have wolves or something that can score that is not really taking up a unit slot, then they could focus on, you know, just grabbing some free points every round while they focus what, you know, their real combat units at your elite units, and, you know, just things to keep in mind. And like Brett was saying, I definitely agree. The swapping the middle objective to always be the -2 or the 2 victory points was an amazing change. We actually had a house rule for a while where in tournaments, the middle objective, it was kind of the same. Ours was you still randomized all 5 objectives, but if at any point one of them was the 2 victory point one, you just simply swapped the middle before the two. Use the middle one with the other one. That way, if the two victory point objective came up, it was in the middle. Otherwise, it was still random. So definitely an amazing change, and props to Simon for that change. Anything else you wanted to add for this one, Brett?
Yeah, so the interesting thing with this one is actually with as far as the placement of the tokens. So as we get into some of these scenarios that have the objective tokens on the field and some of them that don't. So Game of Thrones, you can actually customize where they're placed on the field. And it kind of gives you another element of control where you can kind of tailor build the field to what you've got going on in your army. So, for example, if you've got your a list like what I like to run with Night's Watch, which is four relatively elite units that aren't necessarily moving at the speed of light, but they're pretty tanky and strong, I'm probably going to take those two tokens that I get to place, and I'm going to watch what my opponent does. And if I place one pretty close to the center and he counters by placing one pretty close to the center too, I might either counter by sticking one where I can just stick Ghost and force him to commit some of his combat units that he needs to deal with my veterans. He's going to have to commit at least one unit to go over there and get Ghost, or he's giving me a victory point for the entire game. Then if that doesn't happen, I might just put those tokens relatively close to each other because I believe in my ability to sit on a point and hold it. So as you go into this game mode, you need to look at what you've got in your army. Can you really spread the field? Is your army capable of taking the center, holding the center, and or contesting the center, as well as contesting both flanks? If you're not able to do that, you might want to consider where you place your tokens to give yourself some kind of an advantage to where you can do like a flank heavy on one side, because I think a lot of people make this mistake where their army is not necessarily built to spread the field that way, and they try to like, okay, well, I'm going to put this one unit of veterans in the center or your sworn shields or whatever you have. And then they try to kind of spread everything out. And it's like, I'm going to have this total board presence, and it just falls apart because a lot of those units aren't meant to function alone. So keep in mind that you can, if it's to your advantage, you can spread the field, or if it's to your advantage, you can compress the field. So I like this scenario for that reason too. You know, the token placement, you can tailor build it to what you've got going on.
Yeah, I was going to mention too, so with the whole placement of the token thing, so sometimes, I mean, it's obviously situational, but sometimes I think it's interesting when, like, you sometimes you think, like, okay, I'll just put them closer to my side, but then if you put them too close, like, you have to think, too, that sometimes, like, whoever's going to be sitting on them will be out of the fight. So that kind of goes back to, like, what we said earlier, that having more units on the field is beneficial, so things like you said, dogs and significant units. So if you do something like that, you can keep them kind of like out of the fight, sitting on the tokens, have everything else kind of do the fighting for you. So that's something to look out for, or plan accordingly, I guess.
Well, the other thing is they can win the dice off and flip the table board on you. If you deployed tokens super close to your deployment zone, thinking that it's going to be your deployment zone, and maybe they don't do that, and then they swap you sides. Now maybe they're super close to two tokens, and you're like, crap. So there's actually a lot to think about with that one.
Yeah, but usually what happens, usually, like, for example, if I prepare for that, usually the other opponent, I mean, obviously it can happen, but usually they're not as prepared for that. So then, like, if they do flip it, then it just makes it easier for me because I'm only fighting, you know, three units instead of five, essentially. And then eventually they're going to have to leave the token to come fight, or I'll just get to them eventually and wipe them out. So, like I said, unless both of you are prepared for that, which you can tell based off of how they place. Like, if they place them closer, then you're obviously both prepared for it. If not, then they may not even flip it for that reason. Whereas what I found, at least in my experience.
Yeah, I would say definitely if you're the token placement is a big deal, depending on especially depending on where terrain is going and what terrain. If you're a more elite list and you have less units, you're going to want to place them all together.
Put them up.
Or else you're going to cluster them together. Otherwise, you're going to run into the situation like Brett was saying. Let's say Brett was your opponent and he's got a wolf, or if he's Starks and he's got wolves, you definitely don't want that one objective just sitting off in the nowhere. Granted, you know, he has two objectives he's going to get to play, so it's going to happen, but you're going to want to try to factor that. So placing second is actually a lot more beneficial, because then you are going to get the last say where the last objective goes. Granted, this is something you can't really, you know, force. It's just whoever wins the role is who's placing first. But, just know that do your absolute best to cluster them. If you're more elite, you have less units. And if you have a lot of units, especially free ones like wolves, you know, spread them out as much as you can, because you'll be able to get some of those, you know, free units to just camp objectives. So, and then they'll be forced to either split their forces or ignore them. And both cases are good for you, because if they run after your wolf, you can always maybe get a point from your wolf and then run away if you need to, and then maybe harass the unit or something. But, so definitely keep that in mind. There was one more thing I was going to mention about objectives. It's going to escape my mind. So we're going to, I think, move on to the next mission here. So next up is Clash of Kings. I don't know. This mission is really fun. I think, in my opinion, one small tweak would fix basically all the problems it has. But this is probably the most least competitive of the five that we're going to be talking about. So my simple fix, in my opinion, would be just change the deployment to 6 inches. If you do that, then when you get deployed, you're only going to be able to charge on the turn you deploy if you're cav and you have 6-inch move and on a roll of a 6. Granted, that's not counting if you have some, like, free moves or additional move buffs, but at least those are something that you have to add to your unit, and you have to use resources, you know, with either influences or cards or something. You know, it at least takes away the guaranteed charge for all cav, basically. But so with that said, with this mission, because cav have just an innate advantage of being able to just constantly charge every single time they come back on any unit that's sitting on an objective is very, very strong. Now, with that said, I've definitely done well still with an all-infantry list. My game against Craig, who's an amazing player at Indy, he had an all-cav list with 3 NCUs. He had 4 cav and 3 NCUs. And I had 2 wolves and 4 infantry and 2 NCUs. And it ended up he won 10-9, so it's definitely possible. It wasn't like a blowout. You just have to play a little smarter, I suppose. So just keep that in mind. But you're going to have a better chance if you're running at least mostly cav, if not all. I think a revised list I made for this mission was 3 cav and 1 infantry. It was Rob and some sworn shields, Rob Commander and some sworn shields. One outrider and two cavaliers, and then six, seven, nine, nine, 18. 25, 31, so that left 9 points. I believe I took Walder and then Varys as my 2 NCUs. And even though it's not very Starky to have that, I just wanted some more control since I only had four real combat units and then I had the 3 wolf. But, even running just mostly cav and then, like, 1 infantry is still really good too. And the reason I ran, like, sworn shields instead of, because I could have downgraded Walder to another 4-point NCU and made him like the sworn shields berserkers. I wanted more of a defensive unit that could just sit on the objective and weather charges from Cav over and over again with Rob's disorderly and the shield wall and the 3-up save. So definitely keep that in mind when building lists for this mission. Is this is, I think, if you know this mission is going to be in there, this is probably the biggest mission, in my opinion, to tailor for. Because unless you already are naturally running a lot of Cav in your main list, then I guess you don't really have to worry about it. But if you're only running like a Cav, maybe two, you're probably going to want to run at least 3 Cav for this list, in my opinion, because that gives you 1 Cav for every objective that's on the field. What do you think, Jose? Coming from a guy who's playing Baratheons who doesn't have a Cav unit. hang on, Jose. We have Justin with us now. Hang on. It's loading. All right. Hey, Justin. Thanks for coming on. I know you had a lot of stuff you had to deal with.
What if I was a different Justin? How'd you know it was me?
Because you've been on enough times, it tells me your name.
Okay. Yeah, I just new thing going on.
Awesome.
So
thanks
what are we talking about?
Going on.
We're on Clash of Kings right now.
Oh, okay, I gotcha.
Yeah, go ahead.
Dave, what was your question, Dave? I'm so sorry.
Well, I was just saying, coming from, you play Baratheons almost exclusively at the moment, coming from a player who's doesn't have any Cav options other than Flayed Men, who are arguably not worth their points, depending on who you ask, what do you think about this mission, especially when it comes to, your situation?
So like you said, in general, I would say 2 to 3 Cav is probably a good idea for this one. But in my situation where I don't have any Cav, what I tend to do is typically I just assume that they're going to get there first, and then it's just something I kind of have to just deal with. And then the other thing too is so I tend to try to grab the horse as quickly as possible just so that they can't get it, because I'm already going to be super slow. And then what I try to do is, usually I don't like to do this with Baratheons, but I'll try and charge them first. So because if they get the objective first, I'm going to hit them with, the Sentinels or even Stag Knights, because I run Stannis in them with Critical Blow. Just something, to get their ranks down. And then eventually I usually end up taking them, taking the objectives eventually, because I think this is a mission that, in my opinion, a lot of people don't build correctly for. I think we've mentioned it before too, with these objective-based missions, I think you have to really plan to just grab the objectives. And I think it's in this type of game and just miniature war gaming in general, it's hard to not focus on just crushing the opponent. So, someone who runs up there with a glass cannon, or they have their list that's primarily attacky and stuff, what are you, you're going to get there before I am, but then what, you know what I mean? So that's usually what I do. So I'll end up having to charge them first, knock their ranks down. And then I'll tend to be, how I play. I use Eternal anyways. So usually one side, I'll just give it to them and I'll focus on the middle and whatever other side I think is strongest, that I'll be strongest on. So that way, again, that's one unit I don't have to worry about. Right. So okay, fine. You get the 1 point, but if I could overcome everything else, I'll pass you up eventually, but I'll let you take that 1 point, keep that unit out of my way. And then I'll focus all my fire on just two objectives. That's just the way I, and then once I get you off of it, if I'm able to take out a unit or whatever, or tag team someone and take something off, you throw wardens on there or anything defensive. If you don't play Baratheon, anything defensive, it's going to be tough for them to come back, because now they got to come up the field and all sorts of stuff. And even if they have the opposite token of you, you're still I don't know, people think I'm going to just come up behind them. But in reality, I can still deploy stuff from my side and then just end up charging you anyways, on your side or something. So I don't know. Usually if you're playing a slower army with no Cav, just anticipate they're going to get there first. hit them, you know, you're going to end up, you're going to get the charge off if they get there first, because they're not going to leave the token. So you're going to get the charge off. And then I would say, this might be just my personal take, but just turtle. I, you know, I turtle with the one side, and then it usually works out for me, you know, so I don't really tend to have a problem with this mission. Essentially, it's just a very different approach, especially with an army with no cav. This might change once the Baratheon cav comes out. I mean, I don't know what they're going to do, but I'm assuming they're going to also be defensive. So they may be fantastic for this mission if they're like a cavalry that's really defensive. So
they're
going to
hit people with hammers.
Yeah. We'll see when we get there. But that's usually how I handle that, though.
So, Jose, one more question. You know, I know you're mostly just a Stannis player, and even, like, in tournaments, you know, you'll make a Renly list just as, like, a decoy. What would you say for this mission? Would you say who has more of the advantage with, if we're just talking about the two commanders available at this moment, Stannis with his better offense or Renly for the better defense? So Stannis will give you that power to, if they get there first, which they're probably going to, you'll be able to punch into them, or, you know, punch into them with Renly, who's a bit weaker, and then maybe get them off of it, so that way once you're on it, you'll be able to heal and, you know, keep them off of it once you finally take it.
So in my opinion, and then, you know, not because I'm biased towards Stannis, but I think Stannis is better. I am, but I'm trying not to be right now, and just advice I'm giving. But,
I got you.
I do think that Stannis is better, only because Baratheons are naturally a really defensive army. So I think that if you could get that punch to get them off the token, because even if you're whether you're Renly or Stannis, they're going to get there first. So I think if you get that punch to get them off and put you back on, they're still going to have a tough time. Like, yeah, if you're Renly, they may have a tougher time, I guess, getting you off. But, you know, I think Renly really shines in missions that are more combat-based, like, you know, Fire and Blood and stuff like that. You know, something that's a little more combat-based. Anything with tokens, I mean, that especially we start that, you know, 12 inches, they're going to get there first. So in my opinion, I think Stannis is a little better for this situation.
Yeah, I see. I agree. I think definitely the extra punch would be, because you never know, if they're real defensive, Renly might never be able to get them off, and then you might be
exactly.
Stalled all game. But
it's a gamble. I mean, like, if you're able to pull it off, like, yeah, you're gonna pull the tokens for sure. But pulling it off is the hard part when you're playing as Renly. That's the thing.
Yeah,
I think it's
next.
Oh,
how's
it, I
next question was
that.
Actually for Justin.
Oh no.
But if you want to add your, I'm going to ask a question. If you want to add what you're going to say first and then answer the question, just so I can get it out there. I was wondering,
yeah,
as a neutral player, Justin, I know you're not really too fond of the Flayed Men at this moment, but what would you say to Flayed Men in just specifically Clash, since you'll be able to get those charges off to get at least those benefits more often than you normally would in other missions?
Well, I've played this mission since the update without Flayed Men and without a heavy cav list, and it was sad. It's not even a fight, honestly. It's just such a ridiculous advantage at this point, and with neutrals not being defensive in the slightest, unless you count Blackguard, which normally don't do anything, and when I played that game, actually, the Blackguard did the best. They got like a sixth-inch charge and did a lot of damage. It was weird. But I think I would still have to go with a very Flayed Men heavy list, because it's not even a small advantage for cavalry in this mission, in my opinion. It's a ridiculous advantage. It's almost like if you put, besides maybe Baratheons who've got the defensive push, but if you put cavalry against almost any other army, they're going to win. And every army's got amazing cavalry too. Think I would have to, I really just don't want to play it at tournaments, but yeah, I'd have to bring a Flayed Men heavy list for this. Until, well, with the Zorth Sprider change, I might have hope there. Or not change, but different than what we originally saw with them hitting on threes. Not my favorite unit yet, but maybe. Ah, they're so squishy, though. It's hard. They just go poof. But with what I was going to say, I thought it was funny that Jose said if you're defensive, you can – or if they're really aggressive, what are they going to do? Get there first and just hold the line? And I did – when you have squishy units, it's really hard to do. But remember that game we played at your house, Dave? It was like I had like four flayed men and I think like a bastard's girl or something like that. Or not flayed men, cutthroats. And he had just all wardens, I think, right? And I got there first. I got there first. And I literally just took a beating the entire game. Like, I never got to swing back. I was just healing and trying to stay alive. When I swung, I was hit with, like, four dice. But I ended up winning because I held the objective. My poor guys were so devastated, though.
Wardens don't bring that punch, though. That's the problem.
Oh, they punch enough to kill a cutthroat.
With lieutenants, they do. Definitely with lieutenants, they do.
Six of save, seven morale. Not a pretty day.
But, yeah, so definitely keep that in mind when building for this mission. It's definitely something that's going to help you. Though, keep in mind, this is also a mission where ranks, you know, it's based on ranks if you can test. So Cav will have a disadvantage in that regard, but it's a small disadvantage for the fact that they are always getting those first, you know, essentially first turn charges, charging right when they come on. So I think just changing it to 6 inches would make it, you know, it would fix a ton of the problems, because the chances of you charging every single time you come on the board is going to be a lot less likely. Next up we're going to discuss A Feast for Crows. This mission took a while for me to warm up to it. I liked the way it was. Just needed a small tweak. But the way they changed it, like I said, I've warmed up to it, and I definitely like it. Though I think only thing I would change is that when a unit dies, the first two units that die that give corpse piles should be within short range. I feel like long lets you throw it way too far back into your own deployment to let units capture it there, and promotes more of like a turtling if your two units die really quickly. I actually won a mission in Indy where first turn my opponent destroyed two of my units throwing two objectives on my side, and then I just kind of turtled back onto them and I won. But had they only been within short range, I probably would have lost because I would have had to committed more towards my opponent. But as far as like what to build for this, because it's not based on ranks, it's based on once you pick it up, you're controlling it, and you only lose it if you die or fail a is it panic or morale?
I'm not going to say. Test. I have no idea.
I'm looking at it right now. It's if you fail a panic test. So this is definitely a mission where you're going to want I feel like a more elite list is going to work really well here with high morale or low morale, however you want to look at it. Good morale.
Better morale.
Because So especially like Tully Cav, even though if you don't get the charge with them, them having that 5-up morale, being Cav to jump on the objectives like instantly and a 3-up save is going to be pretty big. Especially if you can, if you're rolling random terrain and you can get a tree to try to counteract those corpse piles, or if you're still playing where you pick your pieces and you just, pick two trees, the corpse piles can't stack. So even if your opponent picks two corpse piles, it's not really going to do anything that isn't already happening to you. So definitely high morale elite lists, I think, will be amazing for this mission. What do you think, Brett? I forgot to ask if you had anything to add on that last mission, if you wanted to throw it in there.
Oh, I was just going to add, Lee, I know that cavalry are problematic in that scenario, but keep in mind that sometimes the best strategy for dealing with Cav, especially Lance Cav, like Knights Cavalry, Rock and Tully Cav, knock their asses down to one rank and then just don't kill them. Just, I know it's counterproductive in your mind, but if you don't kill them, they can't come back to life and get another free charge.
if you can bog them down and hold them down without killing them, you might be better off in that scenario, just in that one. But
I tried to do that with Bastard Girls, and it didn't work, but that's their 6-up save.
Yeah, but yeah, because you poke Bastard Girls with a pillow and they die. So. That said, it's also free folk, and I guess now the Night's Watch conscript horde, that's problematic in that scenario too. So I'll pick on the free folk because, you know, everybody knows that Brett has a fear of free folk, okay? It's not that I hate them so much as I hate them because I'm afraid of them, okay?
He hates them.
The fear manifests into hatred. But no, it's because they can have like 11, 12, 13 activations. And in a scenario where you bring them on, and then that's one turn, and then they get to activate, and that's another turn, the free folk player can have like 16, 17, 18 turns. And it gets crazy in a tournament where you're trying to have limited rounds, and some people play a little bit slower than others. I'm not saying people necessarily slow play on purpose, but I can see a free folk game going to like maybe round 3 or 4 in that scenario. I just really hate having unfinished games and, you know, always imagining, well, what would have happened if we had actually gone to round 6, you know? So, but that said, that's one way of dealing with cavalry is to just not kill them, and then they can't come back to life and get the free charge. As far as Feast for Crows, your high morale units are going to do really well. This is one scenario where I'll say for my fellow Lannister players, because still a Lannister somewhere here on the inside, even though I'm playing Night's Watch now. Lannister's going to really, they're going to do well in this scenario for a couple of reasons. Number one, the guard captain. For 1 point, you're sticking your Lannister guard, presumably, but they're not the only unit that can benefit from a guard captain. Mountain's men aren't terribly defensive, as Justin cusses in Mountain's men when he looks at his 5-point cutthroat compared to the Mountain's men.
I love fighting Mountain's men.
Yeah, I know, but, you know, Mountain's men are a little bit more defensive, right? That 1 point of armor makes
a
big difference.
Oh, it matters, for sure.
But, no, you can throw a guard captain in your Mountain's men, you can throw a guard captain in your halberds, you can throw a guard captain in any infantry unit that you want. And in that scenario, they're going to have to effectively make you fail 2 panic checks to get that token away from you. Because the first one that you fail, you get a free pass, right? Because the warding
that's
on the guard captain.
Fail.
Yes, if you fail. The first one that you fail, right, that you would fail, because of the warding on the order, you actually pass. So it's interesting. So and obviously they did that on purpose to trigger things like Lannister supremacy, but instead of saying, like, kill a guy and take no more casualties, you actually pass the panic test so you don't drop the token. The other reason is stalwart is a really powerful keyword, and they have a damn NCU that effectively hands out stalwart to any unit that he wants. So you can get that +2 morale boost from the High Sparrow. And then on the other side of that, you've got Cersei making it much easier for them to bomb their panic test. So you can reserve Cersei for the crown, which kind of goes into that play where you're controlling what they have to do, because it's like, well, I don't want to take a panic check with this unit that's holding this token at a -3, so I have to take the crown away from the Lannisters. Well, odds are you probably didn't want the crown, so now the Lannisters are making you play their game. So I think Lannisters are strong in that scenario. Boltons also, with the ability to hand out panic tokens with Ruth, are going to be pretty strong in that scenario, in that they can do things to make you drop the token after you've activated, and then you don't have the opportunity to go pick it back up. And that's part of the game within the game in this scenario, is playing that panic game. So this is a mission where you can go vicious heavy or panic heavy, or you can do everything that you can to resist panic, like Dave said, and bring those berserkers with morale 4, veterans with morale 5, and Stark with their plethora of stalwart attachments to help them pass these panic tests.
Oh,
or if you're Targaryen. Well, Targaryens have a damn card that's just makes them pass every panic test that round, so that's nice. But it's a card, so I mean, that's better. No, that's the thing with this scenario. Commander's worth 2 points. I think the general idea is going to take like a Brendan Tully-led Sworn Shields unit, get them on the token, and hold on for dear life. So you can play it one of two ways. You can be the guy that tries to disrupt them from the token and start doing some killing, or you can build a list where you're designed to hold on to those tokens. I do like this scenario.
One point I wanted to make is that keep in mind that this mission does have the plus one victory point if your commander is on the objective. But there is some merit, definitely a lot of merit, to taking the High Sparrow or Roost NCU commanders. Even though you'll lose out on that benefit, they add a lot to disrupting your opponent with their... with giving the stalwart basically the plus two morale, and if you combine it with Cersei, or even Roost combined with Cersei if you're running Lannister slash neutrals, or even just neutrals. So running those definitely gives a lot of benefit to, running an NCU commander. But keep in mind, if you're not running those, a lot of the other NCU commanders, I don't feel like add enough to your list to take over a field commander in this mission. One of like the absolute best commanders, in my opinion, for this mission is Blackfish, just because he is a commander that also gives stalwart, or even Jorah Mormont is amazing as well, giving that stalwart and being a commander, a field commander, especially if you can, Jorah on vets, three up morale, and then get on that corpse pile, get the objective, you're still 4 up morale with a 3 up defense save, and he has cards to auto pass it for himself while you're sitting there ticking away with 2 points. Same with Brennan Tully, if you throw him in some berserkers, granted I like him kind of better in great axes, but berserkers, they have a 2 up morale, 3 up on that corpse pile, and then every time they pass that a morale test, they're getting a wound back. And then he has enough healing and defensive cards that can definitely keep that 5-up save unit alive to really just... Because remember, even if your opponent has more ranks than you, that doesn't apply in this mission. It's only if you die or fail a panic. And the chances of you failing a panic, they're going to have to outright kill you. And that whole time, you're going to be getting 2 victory points at the end of every round, starting with round 2.
I think Jarwick has a little bit of merit. He's got the recyclable card that you can bring back over and over again, and you can go cherry pick that gives a unit vicious, and so you can just keep if you've got a unit of crossbows, they're a long range vicious farm, so that's almost as good as claiming the crown. So just a point there. If you fire into a unit with vicious, they're at a minus 3 being on the corpse pile. So it's similar to a crown bomb from Cersei.
No, that's definitely a good point that I didn't think of. I think in that case, though, you're probably going to want 3 NCUs just because you're going to reliably or consistently wanting to swap the board with getting a card. Granted, you could definitely make do with only 2. I just think if you're going to have a replacement NCU, you're definitely going to want 3. And Night's Watch want a lot of the spots anyways, so if you can fit 3 in there, even if it's like Craster, him, and someone else to just save on points there as well, you could do that. Looks like Jose had to step away for a second. We'll jump back to him in just a second. Do you think, Justin?
Jose left. I'm sad. So obviously I play an army that's superbly vicious heavy. In fact, I pretty much just play Bolton, so I have vicious on everything. We don't count Blackguard. So it is really nice because it's easy to get them off the objective. However, at the same time, I don't play Blackguard very much because I don't feel like they fit the Boltons. I mean, I don't think they're the greatest unit, but I also don't think they're worthless. But Boltons specifically are a very high aggressive, high damage army, and those attacks just don't cut it for what they play wise. So I'm always having to leave Blackguard or Bastard's Girls. I've incorporated some Stormcrow Mercs for that plus one armor, and that's helped out a bit, especially because they're only 5 points. Usually they don't even attack; they just sit back. That helps, but I can easily usually get someone off of objectives. That's never a problem. It's just holding them. I too had to get used to it. I can't say I disliked it at first because the old I had a bad taste in my mouth for the old way it was because that game we played, Dave. that, you know, you had like what, two models of Berserkers left, not even two units, just two models. And I had like four units of Cutthroats and I lost the game because I failed every charge except the last one, which then you set for charge and killed him.
Yeah. No, I actually set for a charge twice in a row, I think. I ended up killing, I think, every one of your units, except for maybe one. But yeah, and that unit that was at two ended the game.
To be fair,
at, like,
I killed
wounds.
My units.
Yeah. You killed your units, and then, yeah. So.
I like the new one. It's nice that it's limited to four course files. Although, with the D3+2 and two course files, for whatever reason, I always get five pieces of terrain and the course files, so it gets a little out of hand. That's a lot of terrain on the field, but no, I don't think I've ever had it. That's definitely actually, I guess, one of my favorite ones, which I suppose is makes sense as a Bolton player. Should be, right?
Yeah. So, I think it's safe to jump onto the next one here. We're going to go on to A Dance with Dragons. So this one, very similar in the sense of it's almost kind of in between them for objective purposes. It's almost kind of right in between Clash and Feast in the sense that Clash, you're going to have the three objectives all kind of placed just slightly different. But there's three just in the center, but these ones you pick up. This one
we must
will
be talking
also
about
be
dance.
Yeah, what, did I say something different?
Oh, no, I didn't hear what you said.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, if I don't know if maybe I skipped saying what we're on. But, yeah, we're going to talk about Dance with Dragons. So it's a foot deployment, so 12 inches. And this is another one where you're going to pick up the objectives, and you can only lose them if you fail a panic or if your unit dies. And then your commander is also going to give an additional victory point. So definitely a field commander, in my opinion, unless maybe, you know, like we were mentioning before, if you run Roos and or Sparrow or Circe or, you know, just some way to manipulate morale enough that you can make up for not having that field commander is definitely worth it. But I feel like Howland is probably a bad choice for this mission, just because that extra victory, you only need 10 victory points if you're going to four, if you're playing 40 points. And 10 victory points isn't super hard to do in a lot of cases. So that extra victory point goes a long way. So with 12-inch deployment, also keep in mind that 12 inches, like whether it be a march or a free maneuver and then like a maneuver or something, is going to get you to at least touch the objective, and that's all you have to do in order to claim it. So like Berserkers or any 6-inch movement is very strong in this mission. So if you're a Stark player, keep in mind, you know, your Berserkers are going to be amazing here. Any Cav will obviously get it too, but remember with your Cav, when you claim these objectives, your movement goes down to a 2, like your move stat, not your move like distance. So you can have like a move stat 2 and then plus something. For example,
you can't
like if
plus these though.
What
these
I mean
specifically say
not,
you can never modify them or increase them, right?
You can't modify the move stat. So that's why, like, if you retreat, you go your move stat plus inches. So
you can't modify
the move stat. But if you have something that says, okay, two, your move stat is 2, but then plus X amount of inches, not, you know, so it'll show that symbol. So, like, I'm trying to, like, describe it enough for you, those that are listening out there. So if you have something that specifically adds a number value and then the inch, inches, that will increase the distance. So, for example, like I already mentioned, the retreating will still work. It's just that things that increase the move stat, so the foot symbol, don't work. So with Cav, it's going to really severely limit your movement, and it's going to take away, you know, you're paying for those points in your Cav, you know, the fact that you have the free maneuver and, you know, moving extra fast, you're going to lose out on that if you grab them with these. So 6-inch movement units are amazing for this mission, especially ones that are either super, like, offensive or, you know, fairly defensive. or if you're even if you're like a 5-inch movement, but if you have a way to increase your movement just until you grab the objective, because it won't, if you can grab it right away, it won't influence your movement until after you've already captured it. So if you have like a swift advance, that'll work, or if you have, correct me if I'm wrong, but Daenerys, I don't know if she only works on cav, but if she goes on like an infantry unit, she could give that +1 move to a 5-inch movement unit, to that way they can march 12 and then grab an objective. And that can be very strong. Even though you're not going to score in the first round, having that objective, especially with a high morale unit of beginning of the game, it goes a long way. Again, another thing with running Blackfish with Stalwart on like Berserkers, 12-inch move, grab it. Now you're at a 2-up morale, and if there's no corpse pile around, I mean, you auto pass without like Vicious or something similar. And you know, as long as you can play super defensive, even if they another strategy to do, if you get then charged, you could take the maneuver and free retreat your 2 inches plus D6. If you can roll a 6, you're moving 8 inches away, enough distance to then throw a unit in between you and who just charged you, so that way your commander can just, you know, kind of fall back and slowly gain you 2 points every round. So definitely something to keep in mind, that you can kind of still manipulate the movement a bit. What do you think, Jose? I know you had to step away for a second.
Oh, no.
Oh, no. Jose?
Is he muted?
Where'd you go? No, he's still here. All right. Brett, what do you think?
This is another scenario. I generally like this scenario. I think a lot of the time people go for that one NCU token. Obviously, it's incredibly powerful to be able to shut down an NCU as soon as you claim it. I think in a lot of ways you can use that to your advantage, though. If you can tell that they're putting their best units over on that side of the table to kind of go for that, put your commander on the opposite side and go pick the other one up. I know it sucks losing an NCU, but if they're putting maybe a unit that's not their commander, then you're up on them 2-1. You kind of just abandon that NCU, like, boom, take that, your movement too. Good luck getting over here. And then you can kind of create a mismatch on the other side of the vulnerable weaken, and maybe you can get a unit to pick up that center token, and then you're up on them 3-1, just in the static scoring, defend that side of the field and kind of hold that down.
I think it's a really good point, not to interrupt you. I've done that before. Because sometimes you can afford to let your NCUs go away, such as like any time NCUs or like the start of the turn. For me, it happened. And sorry to interrupt you. It's a really good point.
No, you're good.
With Varys, I had Varys and Tycho, and so I just automatically assumed that I wouldn't be able to stop my opponent from getting over there because he placed a bunch of units heavy. So I focused on the other side of the table. And it's not always the best idea, but I popped Varys' tokens as quick as I could because I knew he was going to get shut off. And then I ended up using Tycho as quick as I could, too, and it worked out amazingly for me because I was able to – Varys' tokens just bought me the time I needed to get a strong lead on the other side, and Tycho just healed before he could be shut off. So, like, what did he do? He shut off nothing?
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely, I agree. I think a lot of times it's worth – if you can read their deployment, if they're showing their cards, and you can kind of play them out and see what they're doing, and they're putting all of their stuff on that side of the field where the NCU is, then you can go ahead and counter deploy on the other side. Yeah, I think there's a lot of merit to it. Sucks losing an NCU, but you know what? Starks can kill your NCU, so you got to get used to that idea anyway, right? Another thing I want to point out in this scenario. Now, I don't have an official CMON response to it, and maybe we can bring this question up and get the official answer, but I'm like 99.9% positive that I'm right on this. It has been brought to my attention that a lot of people that play this scenario where they place the 3 tokens the distance that they're supposed to be, They place the center token because it never changes, and then they wait until the roll to see who's player one, and then they place the NCU token and the vulnerable weakened token from the perspective of player one. And I think that's wrong. Player one, not first player. So the player one and player two that they're giving you is just the perspective to set up the field. Like, they would have been just as well to leave no player there. I think people assume that when, if you look in the picture of the scenario to see what I'm talking about, it shows player one, and then to his left, it's ABC, right? So they think, they automatically think, well, ABC is decided by who's first player from their viewpoint. That's not the way it's done. Once you set those tokens down, you assign objectives to it, and then you deploy accordingly. You can still switch table sides, but you don't ever switch what token is where. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, I definitely see what you're saying. I've always played it the other way that you're referring to. But, I mean, I see both sides of it, and I definitely could see it being ruled either way, and I wouldn't have a problem with either way. I think both add an element of strategy.
I think player one, though, is not first player. First player is a defined term in the rule book that's boldened. Player one is just telling you how to set the game mode up. Because the problem is, like what Justin and I are talking about, if you set up your army to, like, say you want to go heavy on the NCU side, and then your opponent beats you on the roll and then flip-flops the side, and now you're deployed heavily, they screwed you by winning that roll-off. And I don't think that it was meant to be that way. I think when you deploy to know what token is where, just like in every other game mode, you know what token is where when you deploy. So I don't know why Dance with Dragons would be different. And I think people get hung up on that player one in that picture, but player one is not synonymous with first player. First player is the defined term. So, but I'm not going to sit and argue with you guys about it. Maybe we can get an official.
Brett, you need to chill.
Brett's wrong all the time, so it's all right.
Everything's his fault, right?
You know what? We can move on. We can move on because we don't have the time to debate it. And I'll actually work on taking that question over to the forums, and maybe we can get Michael or Fabio or one of the other CMON gurus to answer that, and then we'll know the official answer to that. But that said, I think I pretty much said what I want to say about the scenario.
What? You didn't talk at all.
It's similar to Feast for Crows. It's got the panic mechanism, and you've got benefits to having the order of at any cost. And on the counter side to that, you've got Circe. This is another scenario where Roos and the High Sparrow in particular, not having their field presence, can be mitigated because they're able to mess with the morale in a way that you can influence the game enough to where maybe it doesn't matter. For example, the Faith Militant, if they manage to get on an objective, you're pretty much going to have to kill them to a man to take that token from them. Because they're not going to fail a morale test and drop it and hand it to you. So, obviously this one has a bonus for having a field commander. So a lot of people are going to err to that side and want to get their field commander on there to score double victory points. But don't be overly afraid to play an NCU commander, particularly if it's the High Sparrow. And maybe slightly Yarwick again in this scenario because of his ability to toss out Vicious. But I think Roos and the High Sparrow have some merit in this scenario.
So one thing I want to point out before we move on to the last mission for this one, if you do find yourself against Faith Militant in this mission, remember there's three objectives, so it's an odd number. Faith Militant lists, I've yet to see one that wasn't High Sparrow. So keep in mind, if they don't have a field commander, if you can get your field commander on one objective, you're at least tying the number of points that are being scored every round. So I would make that a huge focus. So if you can, in deployment, try to put your field commander in a position where he's going to be able to easily get one of the objectives before your opponent, probably one of the side ones, because you don't want him easily accessible in the middle for your opponent to try to take it away. That way, worst case, if they do grab the other two, you're at least breaking even throughout the game, and it gives you a lot more of a chance. Whereas if they can grab two and you only can grab one, it's going to be an uphill battle because chances are they're not going to lose them unless you kill them, and they have a lot easier chance of making you drop your one objective that you have. So just keep, and if they take it from you, that's even worse because now, you know, like Brett was saying, once they have them, they have them until they die. So especially if you can get a commander that has stalwart and grab it and just hold it, you'll definitely be in a good position to at least make it a close fight, if not, you know, pull out a win. And then the other thing I wanted to point out, this doesn't happen that often, but a little confusion with Clash of Kings and this mission. So each mission has three objectives. Each has one in the middle, then two on the side of that. Dance is the two side objectives are short range from the board edge, and in Clash, it's within long range of the center objective. So it's only the matter of like 2 or 3 inches difference, but it does, you know, it is something to note because I've noticed some people think that it's the same for both missions. But we're going to jump on to our last mission here and kind of wrap everything up with Fire and Blood. This is the one and only objective or mission, I believe, out of every single mission that does not have a single objective in it, with maybe the exception of Storm of Swords that no one plays for competitive. But so this one, and again, it's a field commander bonus, which is whenever your commander activates, you can pass out a victory point to someone within long. This one, in my opinion, is not only because people tend to forget it a lot, but also because you can't start doing it right away. So normally you're passing out, I don't know, maybe three throughout the game. It's, in my opinion, not as beneficial as the plus one victory point if you're holding the objective, because you then, even though you're passing them out, it's not guaranteed that you're going to get them. You're going to have to then kill that unit that you pass it out to. So and what I'm getting at is that if you wanted to run an NCU commander in this list, it's definitely a lot more viable, in my opinion, than in running it in some of the other lists or in the other missions, which give you a bonus for having a field commander on an objective. So what do you think about this mission, Jose?
In general, it's one of my favorites. And then I get your point that, you know, you could run the NCU, and it's, but I NCU commander, but I like running the field commander better. Obviously, because you dish out the extra tokens and stuff. This mission, I think, is a lot of fun because I think it allows people to bring really like just killy units, and it's the most just straight. It's like I guess I don't know how to phrase it, but I guess like the most traditional like miniature war game style almost, right? There's no objectives, and it's just like my army against yours. So I really like that. I think with the new change with marked units too, where like the unit that's marked gets +2 attacks, is huge. It changes the game a lot. I think because you have to really think of where to put it. Because before, I feel like everybody would just like target the weakest unit and be like, all right, cool, I'm gonna just put it there and just take the, you know, get the make them marked. But now with +2 dice, I mean, it's tough, especially against a list that's like an elite list. You know, you bring all elite units. Like it's, sometimes your opponent has a tough time even deciding where to put the marks. You know, the who to make marked essentially, which is it can be difficult, but it's fun. I think it rewards players. It's the most rewarding mission for elite list, I think.
So, agreed.
That's probably my take on it. This is, like I said, it's competitive, but I think it's the most fun competitive mission, and then it's really, like I said, and really rewarding for elite units. So.
Yep, I agree. So definitely, when you're list building for this one, this is probably, like you were saying, the best mission for an elite list, and gives you incentive to not run any like weak links. So like my initial main list had like one Great Axe, two Berserkers, and one Sworn Sword, but I took some of the points away from my attachments to turn that Sworn Sword into another Berserker to help with this mission. Because when I had that Sworn Sword, they were an easy mark for my opponent. But then when I changed it, they had no good option. And because of people's fear of Great Axes, they just almost always just mark two Berserker units, which, I mean, it's a no-win scenario in that case, and it definitely gives merit to having an elite list and hurts more of like a horde list that doesn't have like any super hard-hitting units. But I'm going to introduce Chris right now. He was able to make it on. Glad to have you on, Chris. What do you think about this mission?
So this is by far my favorite mission of all of them. And even when I'm demoing games, this is usually my go-to one, just because I like killing things. I'm a very offensive-minded guy. And when introduced in the game, I think other people really want to kill stuff too. So I think this mission is perfect for an introductory one. Though I will say, I very rarely, if ever, remember to give that extra victory point when I activate my commander. I just get too excited about killing stuff, and I just don't do it.
I can vouch for that.
I think all y'all can vouch for that one.
Not Brett.
But, you know, I think it's a lot to the more elite type list for this thing. It gives me a good chance to bust out my Fallers of Bone. And, well, not so much Giants, but I do like the Giants. You know, the extra attack dice doesn't really help me that much in this one. But, you know, I like them.
Anyway. It helps you to don't miss.
Yeah.
Well,
Not only that, don't forget that a marked unit will give you an extra victory point when they kill something. So marking a Giant, though it may seem to some people like an easy no-brainer, in my opinion, it's still a decent play to mark them, but it's definitely not like, don't think that you're going to have no repercussions by marking a Giant, because they are definitely very killy, and you're going to possibly give them some extra victory points if you let that Giant get in and kill some units.
And this also requires me to actually like make my charges to actually get to combat, which God knows that doesn't happen very often.
Now, one change I wish they would kind of make in this mission is some penalty for, being too close to your deployment zone or too close to your board edge. So, like, I don't know, if you start your activation within 12 inches of your board edge starting round 2 or something, you're worth an additional victory point. And the reason for that is it'll prevent people from castling. I can't tell you how many times I've played this mission where, you know, people just kind of castle up in their own deployment. And sometimes it's beneficial, and I know some people swear by it. But this is not a game where castling works very well. It makes for a very boring game. And I know sometimes it's the strategic thing to do, and I can't fault anyone for if that's part of their strategy. But if they made an incentive to make sure you didn't, I think it would just increase the overall enjoyability of the mission while taking away that choice of castling, and make people kind of think a little more out of the box with positioning and where to send their units or something. Because if you have to be 12 inches away from your board edge and they have to be 12 inches away from their board edge, and then each tray is 5.5 inches, that's 12 plus 12 plus 11 makes you, 13 inches away from each other. I mean, you're close enough to each other now that, you know, anything can happen.
Targaryen.
Yeah. But, I mean, 13 inches is definitely within the realm of infantry, too.
But it's in the realm of the whole... All of them can get to me.
But I think infantry benefit from that more than Cav do, because Cav have much longer threat range.
I got annihilated.
So, what do you think, Justin, about this mission?
Like I said, Targaryens. I like the mission a lot. Honestly, usually it's I don't know how much merit I put into it when it comes to like competitive play because it's very, very swingy. For instance, my last two games, this is how the score ended up going. The first one, I was, what, like 2 points to like eight, and then, no, 2 points to like six, and then I lost the game because he got a crap ton of points. But we played it out to see what would have happened, and if it would have gone to the next turn, I would have had a very, very, very good chance of winning the game because I would have gotten like 8 points myself. And then the last game I played, I was using four bastards girls. I'm going to admit to that out loud. It didn't go too well. Two units in like one activation because of overrun. And so that's half my army already. I'm like, oh my God. And it was like both of my marked units, I think. I was like, oh my God. and there was nothing I could do, but I ended up killing, by activating my commander enough and killing enough unit of his marked units to where it ended 10-8, even though realistically I got annihilated because I'm pretty sure I got tabled, if I remember correctly. And he still had like full vets and full outriders. So there was no hope of winning if it were any other scenario, but it ended up 10-8. And realistically I should have lost at like 10-0. So I think it's highly swingy. I think it's very fun though, because it is wonderful. Like, if you have Braun and Bastards Girls, and for whatever reason they mark him, whoo, it's a bad day. Eight shots, 10 attack.
He could be my nephew and mark Knights Castle Rocks with
that poor guy.
Rides.
I felt bad. I got 8 points in the first activation of the game. I felt bad.
It was really bad.
I was a bad person. I'm going straight to hell for that one.
Just anyone listening, and that was a friendly game. That's, you know, granted our local, we allow the Kickstarter units, but that was a friendly game, so that was another reason why the Mountain That Rides was allowed. And my nephew realized his mistake after he did it, but one upside to that game was it ended so quickly. You got to start a new game almost instantly.
It ended in three turns, essentially. Like, first round, the game was over.
Yeah. Not even three. I'm pretty sure you won second round.
No, three turns.
Oh, yeah, three turns.
I had 10 points in three turns. And it was not three of my turns. It was my turn, his turn, my turn.
So Fire and Blood, definitely try to make more of an elite type list. Free Folk can definitely still do it, like Chris was saying. Followers of Bone now are amazing, and you know there are 6 points, 7 points. You know, if you're taking the specialty unit, 9, possibly 8, 9 point investment. But especially in a mission like this, you know, it would definitely be worth it. There'll definitely be some hard hitting guys. Even if they're more defensive, you know, marking like wardens in this mission is still kind of scary because now you're pushing their offensive power, you know, to be something to not, you know, laugh at. You know, you're still hitting on fours, but, you know, 9 dice, that's like Renly, especially if you don't give them any other good options. And they, you know, if you have the Stormcrow Lieutenants in there, I mean, you're having, what, 10 dice with Sundering? It can get pretty crazy. So,
if you take the money.
Definitely, yeah. Well, if you have Alistair and Peter, you're unless they also have, if they have Varys and or also have Alistair, you're guaranteed the money 5 rounds in the game. I guess they could have, what's her name? Not Marjorie, the old lady.
Olenna?
Olenna.
Olenna.
So it's definitely something to keep in mind. Also, this mission has 18-inch deployment. Don't always think that you have to deploy right up to the 18-inch mark, especially if your opponent has ranged units, or maybe if you have ranged units, you're going to want to. But it leaves a lot up to chance of first-turn charges, first-turn shooting you, especially if you don't go first. So I like to deploy to where I'm at least 18 inches away from them. So if they're deploying right up on the 18-inch line, or mark, I will deploy at 12. If they're deploying at 12, I'll deploy at 18. So it all just depends. I don't like being super far away, but I just don't like being within that like 12-inch gap, or even possibly 14, because you know a 12-inch range unit with a 2-inch shift gets you with a free attack first turn, and that could be pretty devastating. So keep that in mind, that you don't have to deploy right up on the line. And deploying even just like an inch back could be a big deal. So I think that kind of wraps up everything for the all the missions. Going to announce
you don't give
the...
A, you don't give a shit what I have to say about this scenario?
Oh, I just figured you talked enough this whole time that, you know, you're out of words.
Brett, chill.
I'm just messing.
What do you think, Brett? What do you think?
No, I don't want to know what he thinks.
Well, I mean, now since you asked.
I don't either, but...
No, this scenario is really... It's really fun. It's a good old classic bloodbath scenario. I wasn't too sure how I felt about the +2 attack dice to it initially. I've pretty well warmed up to it because it's like, yeah, they can build this super elite list and bring it to that mission. But, you know, at some point, like you guys were saying with the wardens, name any unit that you want to have 2 more attack dice. Like, I name one that you want.
Poor fellow.
I really want you to be better at killing me.
Poor fellow.
I don't know, man. They can get that +1 to hit card from the sparrow.
They're hitting on
thundering.
They can hit okay.
Yeah, but you know,
that's probably the best unit to give it to. That's the best unit in the game to give it to, though.
I mean,
not great.
I'm going to give it to you, okay? You got it.
It ain't fair.
But no, our good friend John Hurley, he makes this disgusting list, and it goes back to what Dave was talking about. His Fire and Blood list that I had to face was Eddard's Honor Guard, 2 Tully Cav, and Great Axes, when Great Axes were the bee's knees. They still had Mighty Cleave. Yeah, because he had a Sworn Sword Captain in them. So it was like, fuck off, fuck off, fuck off, fuck off. Like, what choice do you have to make? And
you just went
not
over our swearing limit, Brett. We're allowed one swear an episode. Man, now we can't swear for the next, like, 4 episodes.
God damn it.
No. Sorry, guys.
5 episodes.
No, it's terrible. Sometimes you're going to get in a situation like that, and I can't even begin to tell you what to mark. I marked the Honor Guard and the Great Axes in this situation, but it was like, no matter what I marked, it was a terrible decision. But I think the scenario is really fun. You're really going to have to look at what your opponent is bringing, because I think generally when people see that this mission is there, they're going to have at least one of their lists just loaded with elite units, and they're going to make you make really bad decisions. My personal suggestion is don't mark a ranged unit or a unit that can shoot and get away from you. Like when I play Night's Watch, people mark my trackers. You're doing me a supreme favor by marking my trackers.
Vets, girls, vets. Obviously, you wouldn't want to mark a vet.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, I think ranged in general, you don't want to mark them. I don't mark Lannister crossbows. And I think it has to do with being able to take multiple attacks with the free attack spot and not having to be engaged with you to do that. So especially a long-range unit, there's no way I'm marking any long-range unit. Stark Bowman come to mind, there's no freaking way. I'm
what
giving
about
a range
Stormcrow Archers?
Maybe those guys. No, I mean, even them, no. I mean, if you play them right, they can attack for free with the bags or the sword. So one way or another, they're getting a free shot. So I know they hit on 4s and you clown on them, but I don't really want to take 18 shots. You know what I mean? So, yeah, that's it. I think you guys pretty well covered everything else, so I'm just going to shut the hell up and let you give up your prizes.
Okay.
No, everyone said they want you to talk for 20 more minutes. Everyone's
what? I didn't say that.
Voted.
No, 9:30. I got work in the morning.
Oh, wait.
All of Facebook said it.
No, never mark a unit that has boldness and courage. So Renly or Attachment John or Jamie the Young Lion. Don't give a unit +4 attack dice. Just don't do it.
I think you should do it.
Now I'm done.
He's done.
I would say I would mark John Commander in Vets because I'm already ignoring that unit anyways. So
he doesn't have boldness and courage. It's his attachment.
Oh yeah, I know. I'm just saying. It seems like because Vets would then have 10 attacks at that point, and you could increase it to 12 at the sword, and you could make them pretty nasty. But because I'm already kind of ignoring them, I wouldn't mind marking them depending on what else they had in the list. But anything else you wanted to add, Brett?
No, I'm good. I generally agree with what you say. My opponents generally do mark the Jon Snow veterans, so I think you're on the right track there, at least with what my opponents do.
What? Dave's right? That never happens.
I know, isn't that crazy? Yeah.
Ah! Sorry, I freaked myself out.
Dave, announce our two lucky winners.
All right, so
okay,
Brett. we did a kind of a likes drive, yeah, you can call it that. And for every 100 additional marks that we hit, so at for this one we hit 200 and then 300. So we're giving out two different unit boxes from, I think I have like 30 unit boxes to choose from. And then Brett has some more options if there's nothing in there that you guys wanted. But we're going to continue to do this for every 100 likes, so just keep the likes coming. So as soon as we hit 4, we'll give out a unit box. At 500, I'm going to give out a unit box and a Stark or Lannister starter half of their choice. It will be two different people, though. So at 500, we'll give one person the starter half or a unit box. Now, if you have no use for a starter half and you win it, I will let you pick two unit boxes instead from what we have available. So just keep that in mind. So for our 200 and 300 mark, our winners are Colin McGill and Max Earl Anstey. I apologize if I said either of your names wrong. I will be reaching out to you guys so you guys can kind of pick between what we got. And then I will try to send as soon as I can and get your addresses and whatnot. And shipping will be on us, even if you're out of the United States. And if it costs more than $1, I'll make Brett pay for it. So, yeah. So that kind of wraps up everything. What was that?
I said, that sounds pretty fair to me.
Yeah, I thought so, too. I took a poll, and there was only one vote, and it said that you should do it.
Sounds legit to me.
So,
you tell me my vote doesn't count?
No, that was your vote.
You forgot to vote. That's what happened. I forgot to publish the poll, and I was the only one to vote, but I didn't have time to fix it, so we just...
What a nice guy.
So, yeah, I know. The nicest there is. At least, for what it's worth, I'm the nicest guy out there to Brett. You should see what everyone else does to him. It's pretty
He's
bad.
The nicest one in this group,
sorry.
Too.
Yeah.
True.
Do you guys have any shout-outs you want to do to anyone, anything, any tournaments in the future after all this is down or anything at all?
Keep it real, everybody.
Nothing official. I'm sure that everybody is going to be, like I said, busting at the seams to get into an event, so it should be pretty fun when this all clears up and everybody's allowed to play. I'll just do a general shout out. I know that people are bored and looking for content. If I forget some people, I'm really sorry. It's not because I don't love you. Chase from On the Table Gaming. obviously does tons of content. He does a lot of really good stuff for the community. He has taken over the Song of Ice and Fire Builder website. He's really streamlined it. If you haven't looked at it, go check it out. He's working on getting the new Baratheons in there already. Chase does a lot of work for the community. Within that little organization as well, you've got Ben with Blitz Minis, who puts out tons of video content, really high quality. The Mythico Studios guys stream a live game on Thursdays. They won't be doing that now, but they and others are working on getting some tabletop simulator games working so that you guys can get your fix in that regard. Yannick Burr with Tabletop Warden does a lot of great content and podcasts as well. And I'm not going to keep going, so that's my sponsorships for the day. Those are the ones they're the ones that paid me anyway. Sorry, guys.
No, that's my chance.
Everybody decides to spread the love to the community. Check out people's channels, subscribe. There's tons of content for this game, so just spread it around and see what everybody else has to say about the game besides us and me. I just talk way the fuck too much. Just ignore me.
I don't.
Episodes.
We're at 7, Dave. You lost count.
Yeah. We'll just say 10.
I think it's really just Brett's fired.
Yeah.
Sorry, Brett. I tried. I fought for you.
I will add anyone out there that has like a channel or any sort of content creator that they like, definitely, you know, consider supporting them in some way, either if they have a Patreon or some other like way to, or even just sharing out their channel, let other people know they exist. There's some people, you know, still, you know, we've been doing this for like 2 months now, and some people that still didn't even know we existed. So just let people know in your gaming group and just online that all these different places, you know, exist that they can get some of this content from. Share ours out. Currently, we're not taking any sort of like donations or anything at the time, but definitely the best thing you can do for us is just share out our channel, like the page, especially if you want to get us to that next mark so we can give out some more free stuff. We definitely like giving back to the community and, you know, giving some free product out there. So definitely just share, you know, that's share our channel out. That's the best thing you can do for us at the moment. We might consider like a Patreon or something in the future, but it's not really something we've talked about. So yeah, in the meantime, just share out the channel, and that's definitely the way to support us.
What
thank
episode
you,
are we on,
Dave? Guys. We're on, I want to say, episode 13, 14.
Oh, that's like 3.5 months.
Oh, yeah, I guess you're
one
right.
One last final thing on a very serious note with no joking. Your local game stores really, really need you right now. So reach out to those guys and see if they have some way to deliver you some things. Stock up on your paints if you can afford to do it. Stock up on some paintbrushes. The local game stores really, really, really need the help right now because they, at least in Indiana and I'm sure in Illinois where you guys are, they've been closed. So if you can do anything to help them out through this time so that you have a place to go back and play, they've supported you throughout the game, so do what you can to support them right now.
Yeah, I second that completely. I've been making it a very diligent point to order anything through my store, even though it takes more time.
Yep, because remember, you know, you only have a place to, you know, play publicly because of them usually. Playing in your basement's cool, and I've done it for a long time, and I've, you know, met at people's houses to, like, have some beers and stuff, and that's awesome. But usually you don't meet new people and you don't expand your game that way. It's very hard to get new people into your group if that's the only way you do it. So I, you know, gaming clubs are definitely the way to meet new people and to grow the community. So without, you know, your local game stores, that would definitely make things a lot harder. And the last thing you want is for your, you know, some of your games to kind of die off because the community just isn't there. And that's why I like to push for this game so hard. I know it's growing even without me, you know, having to do anything. But, you know, if I can even make it grow a little faster, I enjoy doing that simply for that, to make sure that there's always going to be a group of guys that, or just people in general that will be able to, you know, play the game and help the community grow. So, yeah, I definitely agree with you, Brett. Just make sure you guys are trying to support your local game store in any way possible. I know going online you can find, you know, some better deals, but really ask yourself, you know, is the amount you're saving worth it? I understand if you're saving, like, hundreds of dollars. I mean, hobbies aren't cheap. So I can't really blame people, but just keep in mind how, you know, how much, you know, you're helping a store by buying from them instead. And sometimes, you know, they're willing to, you know, make a deal if they can. I try to avoid asking for a deal if, like, something's way cheaper online. Just remember that online, they're able to avoid a lot of the costs, like the overhead and a lot of the things, and so that's why they can make things cheaper. online is not providing you a place to play unless that online is also a game store. But even then, if they're a game store, you know, halfway across the country, you're helping their community grow, and so that their community can continue to play at a place, but yours won't. And if everyone had the mindset of just order online from, like, some eBay place, eventually your shop's probably going to go under, unfortunately. So, you know, not to, like, guilt trip anyone into buying from their shop, but just try to think about it next time you're making a purchase. I always try to, you know, tell myself when I see something online that's, like, $5 off, it's like, well, I'd rather give my money to someone I know, you know. So, just, I guess, another way, you know, think of it that way is that, you know, you're able to give that money to someone you know rather than some random person that you've never met on the internet. So, I don't know, just something to keep in mind, you know, now that Brett has gotten us off on this tangent. Thank you for that. But it was a good tangent, I suppose.
Because he's such a nice guy.
Yeah, I know. So
only when I win.
But that's literally always.
Game store.
But Brett always wins.
If it wasn't, don't go spreading lies like that.
We wouldn't know each other.
She didn't cheat.
No, Chris has a point. Chris said if it wasn't for game stores, we wouldn't know each other.
Yep,
that is very true.
True words were never spoken.
Yeah.
Support your local game stores.
Yep. Just think about all the people that you would not know if your local game stores or store did not exist.
Don't tell me that. I want to know, Brett. My life would be so much better.
Yeah. You got to take the good with the bad, though.
That's true. I wouldn't have met Chris, my Jolly Green Giant friend.
I can't. You guys, we need to say goodbye. We're bad at goodbyes.
Yeah. You know, you're bad at goodbyes. All right. Thank you guys for coming on, all of my co-hosts that, you know, make it a point to be on pretty much every single week. And thank you all guys for tuning in and listening. We do this for you. You know, I know you have a lot of other things to do, but you take the time out of your day to listen to our show, and we all really appreciate it. Thank you all so much for listening in. This is the Small Council, and it is dismissed.